From WSLR, LP, 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP, 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Sarah Dennis with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, April 15th. Governor Ron DeSantis is accusing House Republicans of joining a smear campaign against him and First Lady Casey DeSantis over the Hope Florida Foundation. This follows reports that the foundation used $10 million from a Medicaid settlement to fund political groups without legally notifying the legislature. Lawmakers from both parties are calling for an investigation, questioning whether taxpayer money was misused. DeSantis denies wrongdoing and says the House is trying to sabotage his agenda, depending tensions between him and the Republican-led legislature. On Tuesday, the House Commerce Committee will hear two bills environment advocates consider harmful: HB 579, which allows agricultural land to be developed without local oversight, leading to unchecked sprawl, 1,000 Friends of Florida fear. And then there is HB 991, which eliminates community redevelopment agencies that fund infrastructure and affordable housing. Additionally, SB 1264 in the Senate proposes eliminating regional planning councils, which are crucial for sustainable local growth. Finally, SB 80 needs an amendment to match HB 209 in protecting Florida state parks from harmful developments. 1,000 Friends of Florida urge supporters to contact committee members to oppose these bills and support stronger park protections. Sarasota County Schools has officially opened student registration for 2025-2026 school year. This includes current students, first-time kindergartners, new residents, and those returning to the district, whether from homeschooling or other school systems. All registrations must be completed online through the Focus Parents portal. To learn more, visit sarasotacountyschools.net. This has been Sarah Dennis with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, April 15th.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 60 of our Changing Environment. The previous show, Corduroy, was hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and this show is being broadcast on April 15th, 2025.
Today we are talking about climate change, microforests, renewable energy, and national security challenges with Gene Jones, the current president of Florida Veterans for Common Sense.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Now, we have a small studio here at WSLR with four people. It's starting to feel crowded. Yet today we have a nonfiction writer, a fiction writer, a veteran, an attorney, an activist, and a Civil War expert. And yet there's an empty chair here.
Gene, you seem to have lived several different lives. Tell us about your path to your current involvement in Florida Veterans for Common Sense.
Well, actually, that was an interesting introduction. I really appreciate that. And I practiced law here in Sarasota for about 25 years. And when I retired, I was very interested in the environment at that time. And as you two know, on behalf of the Sierra Club, I wrote a little book called Adventuring in Paradise, which was graciously published by Pineapple Press. And it was a very popular little book, and the kayak companies in town couldn't keep it in stock. And the reason was not because I was a good writer necessarily, but because it included all the kayak and canoe launches in Sarasota, Manatee County, some in Charlotte and Pinellas County, and people couldn't get that information at that time before the internet anyplace else. So that book was a sellout, and so I was very proud of that little book.
Is it still in print?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I doubt it. Yeah. I doubt if it's still in print.
Okay, so you wrote this book about adventuring in paradise.
Yes.
And it focused on hiking and kayaking and all of those things.
Biking, yes.
And biking, okay. Yes. And so how did you come to be the leader of Florida Veterans for Common Sense?
Well, our group has a very interesting history. Most of us that helped form the group were Vietnam-era veterans, many combat veterans. I am not a combat veteran, but I'm certainly Vietnam-era. And we had some World War II veterans as well who were really instrumental in our leadership. And we formed in opposition to the Iraq War. And the reason we formed to oppose that war was because we saw it as a rerun of the Vietnam War and not likely to accomplish much. And unfortunately, it turns out that we were absolutely correct, and a lot of people were wounded and killed because of that mess, and it really didn't accomplish much.
So tell us about your military service.
I served in the Air Force, and I was very fortunate. I felt like I almost hit the lottery, because instead of being sent to Vietnam, I was sent to Northern Japan, which was one of the best assignments that you could possibly have. And our job up there was to help our ally, the Japanese. Our responsibility was the Northern Air Defense Zone in Japan. And a lot of people don't know this, but the Soviet Union actually captured some of Japan after World War II, or right at the very end of the war. And the Japanese wanted that land back, and they still want that land back. And so the Japanese and the Soviets constantly had a little issue going on about those properties, and they would make incursions and this, that, and the other. But at our air base, we were supposed to have two squadrons of F-4Cs, but those squadrons were in Vietnam. So sometimes there was an aircraft that could fly, but usually not. But the Japanese had what they called the Japanese Air Defense Force, and they were flying F-84s, which were obsolete fighter aircraft from the Korean War, and they could fly when they had fuel. So it was interesting.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so what was the territory that was in dispute between Japan and...
It's the islands north of Hokkaido.
Okay.
Those islands, Sakhalin Island and other islands up there.
Yeah. All right, so the origin of the organization was in relation to that war, but it sounds like it's...
The Iraq War.
Right, it sounds like it's evolved.
It evolved a lot because as the war wound down, of course, we had a lot to say about what was happening during the war because... As you'll recall, this is really history that none of us like to think about very much, but, you know, we got involved in torture and doing a lot of things that were contrary to what we had learned when we served in the military. And so we were speaking out against that. But as the war wound down, we started to see environmental issues as a national security threat. And we saw climate change in particular as a national security threat. And so we started to think about that, and we came to the conclusion that, yes, in fact, climate change is a national security threat. And so we started to speak out on that issue. And then we're kind of a unique group in the sense that when we take a position on something like trying to do something about climate change, we not only try to speak out on the political front, but we also try to take particular action. And so at that time, we did a couple of interesting things. We started what we called Green Path Veterans Farms, which was to have local agriculture and try to move away from, monoculture agriculture. And that was successful, and we worked with several different community organizations to do that. And then that's been transitioned from our group to Operation EcoVets, which I'm proud to say is still in operation. And then at the same time, we were thinking, what can we do directly as a project to combat climate change? So we happened to hear about this Japanese botanist, Miyawaki. And Miyawaki was planting microforests in Japan. And we said, what is that? So we looked into that a little bit, and it seemed like something that would really fit with our community. So we started the efforts to do that. And the first one we built was at the Celery Fields Park in Sarasota County. And we now have 8 or 9 of them. And here's the one thing that we're really proud of. There's other groups that are doing their own microforests. And they've seen that, you know, it's possible to do it. And we've helped some of those groups just on the consulting basis, not with funding and not so much with actual volunteer work, but just helping them out and encouraging them. And we'd like to see 1,000 microforests bloom.
Well, okay, so before we get into detail on Miyawaki and the microforests, talk about, for our listeners, it may not be obvious why a group of vets would come to the conclusion that climate change was a relevant issue. So what are some of the mechanisms or pathways that you all perceived the way climate change was going to become a security issue?
Well, there's a couple of things that were quite obvious.
Okay.
And the first thing that was quite obvious, that military bases were being inundated by sea level rise.
I hate it when that happens.
And that's an expensive proposition. For instance, a Norfolk naval base in Virginia.
Yeah. I've read about that.
Suddenly they found that there was no place to park because the parking lots were covered with salt water. Yeah. Well, that tends to get your attention. Yeah. And then, of course, we had, you know, the Andrews Air Force Base, you know, was basically wiped out by the hurricane. And then Tyndall Air Force Base in North Florida was wiped out by a hurricane. So you start to look at those things knowing, at least we think, that climate change is increasing the intensity and frequency of hurricanes and other violent weather events. Well, we need to do something about this. I mean, you know, this is really affecting our immediate, direct military capability to respond. When you have to fly out all your aircraft from an Air Force base, and then you can't use it for years because you had to rebuild it. You got a mess.
Well, and MacDill has a unique role, right?
MacDill has a very unique role because that's the headquarters for the Central Command.
So if we had a hurricane that took out MacDill,
we're in bad trouble.
Yeah.
No question
okay,
about it.
Okay, so you noticed the inundation issues, and I imagine that's an issue for some of our bases in the Pacific that are on
Atolls? Yeah. Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and then just the effect of hurricanes and maybe other natural disasters?
Yes, and one of the other things that we started to notice and study a little bit about was the fact that climate change not only causes increased hurricanes and severe weather events like this, but it's more insidious in other ways because it changes patterns of drought, changes weather patterns worldwide, really. And a good argument could be made that the war in Syria was caused by climate change. And that seems a little far-fetched till you think about it, because what happened, they had a severe drought. And over years, when you have a drought, you adapt to that drought. And the way they adapted, the farmers adapted to the drought, was by pumping more water, which worked.
Yeah.
But it only worked for a certain number of years because they pumped the aquifer dry.
Yeah.
And then those farmers had no way to make a living. So what did they do? Like, it's natural that you have to do something. You can't live where you are. They moved to the cities looking for work. When they got to the cities, there's not enough work for all those people that are being uprooted. So there was a lot of social tension and uproar, and we know the result of what's happened there. I mean, it's really tragic.
Yeah.
And it's a good argument that can be made that war was a result of drought.
Yeah, so the changing climate conditions, whether it's droughts, floods, or other disturbances, change the societal structure and destabilize society.
It destabilizes things, and one of the things that it destabilizes, and Syria is a good example, it sets in motion big migrations.
Right.
And we've certainly seen that here in the United States. We have more people trying to migrate to the United States because a lot of the countries that they're coming from, they can't make a living because the climate's changed.
Right. Yeah.
So it seems like the military writ large used to have a plan to address climate change. And now that Trump and Hegseth are in office, those plans are no longer being followed, right?
Julie, I would say that that's a bit of a political statement, which, which I have no problem with, because here's our position on that. When we started thinking about climate change, it was almost coincidental that the Pentagon was really starting to think about it too. And about the same time that we decided we would take a public position, the Pentagon said very specifically they had their annual review, climate change is a national security threat. Not only is it a national security threat, but it's a multiplying threat because of these various issues with migration, political instability, et cetera. So they basically maintained that position until the Trump administration. And now, of course, we have this thinking where if you think about climate change and maybe other things too, that's somehow woke. Mm-hmm. that you're educated, mm-hmm. that you're looking at reality. I mean, it's amazing to me that people take the position, like our governor, to call climate change a hoax and criticize people that are thinking about it and trying to do something good for the community, good for the world, and protect our country, and criticizing us, saying that we're some kind of leftist lunatic.
Yeah.
So is our Florida Veterans for Common Sense allied to a national organization, Veterans for Common Sense?
We work with Veterans for Common Sense, but we're not formally allied with them.
Okay.
Needless to say, there's overlap with our membership.
Yeah.
But they're a terrific group. The National Veterans for Common Sense, they primarily focus on veterans issues specifically. As an example, the PACT Act, they were really instrumental in helping getting that legislation passed.
And what is the PACT Act?
And that's legislation specifically to help veterans that were harmed by their military service from burn pits and toxic exposures and that type of thing, which, by the way, Sarasota really benefits from that PACT Act because part of the funding comes right here to Sarasota for the Roskamp Institute to do research on those issues. And they've worked real hard on particularly some PTSD issues and toxic exposures. And so that's a very important act. But that's the National Veterans for Common Sense. That's their primary focus. They don't get into these other, and I'm going to say political issues, like we might.
Yeah. So I saw on social media that Mark Milley, who and he was making a statement on behalf of Veterans for Common Sense nationally.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
he's a good man, and you know he's one of those service members. You know, that his career was really cut short by the Trump administration. It's just not right what's been done to him. And, you know, there's other examples too, like Venman. You know, it's just a shame. You know, their careers were really cut short because they were willing to speak out in support of the Constitution or in support of just plain rationality.
Mm-hmm. And common sense.
Like common sense and, yeah. And climate change.
Uh-huh. Common sense keeps coming up. So it's interesting that big thinking entities that have to have a long-range vision, whether it's the military or the insurance industry, are identifying climate as a big deal. And then, as you said, we had the governor who wants to deny that any of this is happening. And meanwhile, the insurance rates are driving people crazy in Florida.
Yes, they are driving people crazy, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
Excuse me. In Florida, there's no question about it. It gets hotter every year. I mean, if you live here, you know that. I mean, how can the governor deny that? And how can he deny that the Gulf of Mexico, the bays around Miami, last summer, I believe it was, maybe the summer before, but the temperatures in the bay was over 100 degrees. Well, you might as well go into a hot tub.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not normal. So to deny that, what is he thinking? What are they thinking when they say this is criticizing people and name-calling, calling them woke or something like that? I mean, well, all we're trying to do is say, this is what we're living with, and we need to address it, and we need to correct it. And please help us.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if we could get the governor and the legislature to get on board to do something about climate change. We could make a big difference.
You know, it's interesting. Each year they have a legislative delegation meeting for the local delegation, and they take comments from individuals, but primarily from local governments, nonprofits, the hospital shows up, the colleges. What do they want from the legislature? I wasn't able to go this past year, but for several years in a row, Longboat Key would show up and say they needed help with sea level issues.
Sure, of course.
And I think they had to like couch it as resilience, or they have to sort of work around it. But the Barrier Island communities are very aware of this situation. Now, Julie, weren't you telling me you'd been reading that about property values dropping in the Sarasota area?
Yeah. They've dropped 7.9%. The average property value has dropped 7.9% in the past compared to 2024.
And do you think that's we'll have to see if that's reflected in the property appraisers' assessments. You know, the county sort of assumes that the valuation of all the property in the county is going to go up each year, so
yeah,
they can keep the millage the same and they'll mm-hmm. have more money to work mm-hmm. with. But if we start seeing property values dropping, we're going to have to make some choices. So was the assumption that those depressed property values were attributed to hurricanes?
I think it's a combination of insurance.
Oh yeah,
and hurricanes.
Okay, so
and
a
stuff
double
like that.
Whammy, both related to
yeah.
a climate.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about microforests.
Well, microforests are a subject that I really get excited about, and our group gets excited about. We, as I mentioned, we heard about this Japanese botanist, and he uses a technique to plant trees differently than a natural forest. And what he does, basically, to oversimplify, he plants trees very close together. And because of that, the trees compete for light and nutrients and everything else. And when they do that competition, just like people, sometimes when we have competition, we do a lot better. And those trees grow really fast. And in some environments, I don't think it's true in Florida from our experience, but in some environments, those forests can make a 100-year forest in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's very incredible.
Mm-hmm.
In Florida, it remains to be seen. I mean, we just don't have enough time to know how they're going to turn out. But the most successful microforest we have two of them in Stony Brook. And those have just been really exceptional growing microforest. They came through the hurricane almost unscathed. And the soil there is a native soil, and we plant all native trees. And it's also backed up to a native environment. And I think that probably helps the microforest. But some of the trees, I would say they were put in about 3 years ago, and some of them are probably 25, 30 feet high already. I mean, they have really grown.
What species are we talking
about?
We're
talking about, you know, the basic Florida species, cabbage palms, slash pines. Let's see, what are some of the other? Oak trees, of course. And,
okay.
And then a lot of shrub-type material like sea grapes and mm-hmm. buttonwoods and, mm-hmm. you know, all native stuff.
So is any group studying it, like doing research or collecting data?
Well, that's a little bit of a sad story. We had someone, one of the reasons we got started in the microforest is, you know, combating climate change because trees sequester so much carbon.
Right.
I mean, they pull, a big oak tree can pull, you know, 200 or 300 pounds of carbon out of the air in a year.
Yeah.
So if you have a lot of trees, they're pulling a lot of carbon out of the air. Well, we had a professor from New College that was going to help us with that, but unfortunately he's moved away.
Yeah, well, that's probably another story.
That's right. So talk about how planting microforests is socially valuable to the Florida Veterans for Common Sense.
There's several ways that it's socially valuable, and what we really enjoy doing, we enjoy working with other groups, and one of the best examples is probably the Audubon. The Audubon has been just crucially helpful to us at the microforest at the celery fields, and the reason is at the location that we have in the celery fields, there's no way to water that forest when the young trees... And it that forest was hit by a drought about 2 or 3 months after we planted it. And without the Audubon, probably the forest would have died, but they allowed us to use the water from their facility. So they've been just very cooperative with us, and we hope to cooperate with them on the quads project with the rewilding of some of the quads at the celery fields. And we'd like to do a microforest there, and I think we're going to be able to do that with the Audubon. And working with other groups, the various Rotary clubs in the area, the basically across the entire Rotary district, which runs from the north end of Manatee County down through, Charlotte County or maybe Collier County. A lot of the different Rotary clubs have helped with the microforest, and particularly the Rotary Club of Sarasota Bay has been just instrumental. They've helped us with funding and helped us with a lot of volunteers. And then the most gratifying thing, perhaps, as far as community involvement, is working with the schools. And we've worked with Riverview and other high schools, and also the Mangrove School with younger children. And we're doing a microforest in Venice now, the Jacaranda Eco Park. And we had a planting day down there about 3 weeks ago or so, something like that. And I would say there's probably 35 students participating in the planting. And that's just very gratifying because that's the new generation coming up, and it gets people out of their house. It gets people doing things and gets them talking to one another. It's just a benefit all the way around. Then there's one last benefit from the Microforest Project that we didn't expect, and it's been a real pleasant surprise. As you know, some veterans have problems with PTSD and other issues, understandably so, and working in the microforest is very therapeutic. And some of the veterans, they've become very possessive about their microforest, which is a great thing. I mean, we just love that. I mean, it's just healthy for people.
Yeah, yeah. Plants can do that. So you may be interested to know, you know where the Audubon Center is at the celery fields.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately to the east is Center Road.
Yes.
The property on the other side of the street has just been acquired by Sarasota County. It's a former goat farm, so virtually, I would say, what would you say, Jill? At least 90% of the vegetation is exotic.
Invasive.
Yeah, oh, sure.
So the county's going to need to go in there if they want to do anything other than a parking lot. That's all going to need to be cleared out. So because of its proximity to Audubon, it would be great if Audubon now could study what the bird utilization is over there.
Oh, yeah.
And then you could, if somebody wanted, then there may be a well on the property where the water would be available, but then you could put in a microforest and study bird utilization in a ruderal exotic community compared to a microforest. That would be pretty interesting.
Jono, I think with that idea, I'm going to have to come back on this show more often. I mean, we have to look into that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and you know, the environmental benefit besides, you know, sequestering carbon, these microforests, they make a little ecological niche, for lack of a better term. And it's been amazing to us at the Surrey Fields, for example, the number of bird species that have been observed in that little forest.
Yeah.
And not only that, but mammals, rabbits, and other animals. I mean, it's really just kind of incredible. And before, it's just mowed.
Uh-huh.
Right. I mean, you're spending a lot of money to mow something.
Yeah.
Which, and that grass, you know, it's, a lot of people think that's pretty, but it really doesn't contribute much to the environment.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The League of Women Voters of Sarasota County presents the panel discussion, Our Affordable Housing Crisis. Can we fix it? With experts including Matt Sauer from the Baranchik Foundation, PJ Brooks from Community Assisted and Supported Living, William Russell from the Sarasota Housing Authority, and John Thaxton from Gulf Coast Community Foundation. This event will take place today at April 15th at 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Selby Library, 1331 First Street in Sarasota, and will also be available to view through Facebook Live. More information is available at lwvsrq.org/events.
Or as the AI people say, Facebook Live. Have you seen those?
No.
They have these computer-generated voices that are reading text. And
yeah.
When it's supposed to be live, they say live.
Live.
So it's interesting.
So, Jean, you mentioned earlier that native soils are available in Stony Brook.
Yes.
And that planting a microforest adjacent to a native canopy area and on native soils is way more successful than what you're finding at the Celery Fields.
Yes. The Celery Fields, that's an interesting circumstance, you know, being, you know, really naive with microforests and forestry in general, you know, trying to learn as we go. The soil out there, we noticed something right away. It was just about impossible to dig in when it's dry. You know, it's almost, it's concrete-like. And the reason is it has a lot of clay in it because it was dug up from those ponds, you know, as part of the stormwater retention program. And so that soil is not the best soil for
trees.
And some foresters have actually said, these trees aren't going to make it. We think they are going to make it because one thing that trees and forests, particularly with the microforest planting style, we think what's going to happen, the soil actually changes because what the trees do, they put channels through the soil, the roots put channels through the soil, and also the fungi start to grow. And that's and we do something a little bit different than Miyawaki. What we do before we plant, we put down a layer of cardboard, and then it's mulched over the cardboard. And the idea of doing that is that that encourages fungi, and that fungi helps change the soil too. So we think over time, the soil will change at the Celery Fields and be better, and it'll be healthy for the trees. But it's going to take a long time. I mean, it's a very unnatural environment, and we didn't appreciate that when we started.
Well, I haven't investigated the soil structure at the former Celery Fields, but you have to wonder if the Celery Fields weren't a giant wetland system because there was an impermeable layer beneath it. If it had just been pure sand below the wetland that preceded the Celery Fields, a lot of that water would have percolated downward into aquifers and drained out. But if it was sort of perched with a marl layer or other clay substance, that would have held the water in. So we've noticed elsewhere, whenever they dig these retention ponds and go below the sort of active living soil layer into the subsoils, they are bringing up a lot of soil with a lot lower permeability that water has trouble moving through.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I've actually seen it with trees, and actually trees that have only been planted for a few years. The roots can almost make a mat. Yeah. And that mat is very... The other advantage of microforest, which we didn't really think about when we first started, but now we're starting to appreciate more and more, is the fact that it's really good for flood control and absorbing water. I mean, number one, the forest canopy slows down that water that's rushing down from these very heavy rainfalls that mm-hmm. we're having because of climate change. Then when it hits the ground, it slowed down and has the opportunity to soak in. And with this root mat, that becomes almost like a sponge. So a lot of that water is absorbed instead of running off right away and causing a flood. So it's very helpful with flood control.
So is there an online group of Florida microforest people that are sharing their insights and what they're learning?
You know, there's not, but that's another great idea, John. We need to have that. I mean,
that's why I'm here.
we've tried to encourage people to do microforests around the state, but it's a little bit hard for us. We're willing to do it. We're willing to travel, uh-huh. but we haven't been successful other than Manatee, Sarasota, and we're doing some work in Charlotte County now too. But, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I'd like to see them all the way from Pensacola to Key West.
Well, you know what interests me is I think it's great that you have the commitment to using native species. And then up at New College and elsewhere, we're starting to see these food forests, which I imagine are 80 to 90% non-native species, food-producing plants.
Probably.
That people are planting bananas and all the different exotics that can grow. And so two similar approaches of sort of high-density planting, one focused on native plants and the other on probably predominantly non-native plants.
We've been very tempted to get into the food forest business uh-huh. because it is very – I mean, there's a lot of advantages to that, but uh-huh. but we're trying to stick with the – so far we've decided to stick with the microforest because – that's a lot on your plate right there.
Yeah.
So something else that you do is you give lectures around the state about Florida in the Civil War.
I haven't done that so much in a while, but one thing that as I grew up in Florida, Florida's changed from, being an old guy. I can see a lot of the way Florida's changed, and so few people know anything about Florida during the Civil War. In fact, a lot of people think that Florida didn't even exist during the Civil War because it's very rarely talked about. But it turns out that Florida was very important for the Civil War. The third bloodiest battle of the Civil War in terms of the men involved was the Battle of Olustee. Up in North Florida, where there were 10,000 men standing, 30 feet from one another, trying to kill one another, and they killed a lot and wounded a lot. And it was really a horror story. In Florida, to make a long story short, there was a civil war inside a civil war. The biggest town in Florida at the time, believe it or not, was Key West.
Yeah,
and Key West remained a Union town during the entire war. And the reason it remained a Union town was many of the Confederates decided that they would take over the fort in Key West. And the mayor said, no, that's not going to happen on my watch. And the mayor put together a militia, and they forced all the secessionists out of town.
This is Fort Zachary Taylor?
Yep, uh-huh. down in Key West. So we have that history there. And then the other thing, the Civil War really made Florida a third world country, for lack of a better term, but it really set Florida back 100 years. I mean, at least it took Florida that long to recover from the Civil War because most of the towns in Florida were burned. Jacksonville was burned. Jacksonville was occupied four different times. Pensacola was burned, occupied. One of the towns that escaped burning was Gainesville. And the reason it escaped burning was because Northern troops came in and occupied the town. but before the Confederate counterattack, they retreated, and so the town wasn't burned. But many of the plantations and the infrastructure of Florida was destroyed during the war, and there was hardly a village that wasn't attacked at one time or another in Florida, and even down here in Southwest Florida, where hardly anybody lived, there were marauding groups, and some of those marauding groups, you didn't know if they were north or south. I mean, it was like a lot of Civil War situations. It was not pretty at all.
Yeah, I guess it was Muir that walked across the state right after the Civil War.
Yeah.
I only know two things about the Civil War in Florida. One is this region was very important in beef production. There were a lot of cattle that were herded or whatever.
Florida was called the breadbasket of the South, and what that really meant was it wasn't bread, it was beef.
Beef, right.
And beef were driven all from Southwest Florida north until they could pick up the trains in Georgia, and then they were distributed to the armies. Florida kept the armies of Northern Virginia and Beauregard's army in South Carolina in the war, because otherwise they would have had no food. And, you know, looking back at the Civil War as a strategy matter, it's amazing to me that the North never really put on a campaign to cut off that supply. They tried it late in the war, but the war was practically over by the time they decided to do that. And there's some interesting little facts. The railroads in Florida didn't connect with the railroads in Georgia.
Different gauges?
They weren't different gauges, but they didn't connect because they were owned by different companies.
Okay.
And powerful, we'll use the term oligarchs in Florida, even though they were supporting the secessionists, of course, because they were big plantation owners, but they also owned the railroad. And they needed, the South, of course, couldn't make enough railroad track. I mean, they were, you know, under the pressure of the war. So they needed to take up those Florida tracks and connect them with the Georgia tracks. And the oligarch said, no, you can't do that.
So the other thing I know is that an ancestor of mine, Henry Tillinghast, was killed in the Battle of Santa Rosa Island, which I think is usually regarded as a skirmish or something, but our family views it as a major battle. And apparently it was a custom at the time, if someone was killed in battle, that it was appropriate to name a child who was born subsequently after the fallen soldier. So my great-grandmother, who was a woman, was named Henry in honor of Henry Tillinghast. And so she went through life as Miss Henry.
That's interesting. That's a good story, Jono.
Well, let me take a shot here, Julie. Safe Place and Rape Crisis Center, SPARC, will host its third annual Teal Walk to raise awareness and show support for survivors of sexual assault. The walk will take place Wednesday, April 16th. That's sounding a lot like tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. From 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Payne Park, which is 2010 Adams Lane in Sarasota, participants are encouraged to wear teal, the signature color of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and to bring their own water. More information is available at www.spark, that's SPARCC.net. And a little nature note here is that the color teal, it is derived from the plumage of the teal ducks. So you want to be thinking about your green-winged teal, not your blue-winged teal.
So it's the green-winged teal that has...
It may be a European teal.
Okay.
But anyway, we named the color after a duck.
Okay.
So you're supposed to wear teal green.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so if people want to contribute to your microforest work for Florida Veterans for Common Sense, how do they get in touch with the organization?
Okay, they can email us at contact@flvcs.us.
FLVCS. Okay.
Dot US. And The other thing they can do is look at our website, look at Florida Veterans for Common Sense Fund. We actually have two organizations. We have a 501c4 and a 501c3. The Micro Forest projects are run through the C3, which is Florida Veterans for Common Sense Fund. And, of course, we would welcome donations to help us out. You could donate an old car just like you can to WSLR.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you could do that from our website. And so that would be terrific. But even more important than donations, perhaps, is volunteering with us.
Yeah.
We can always use help. And, you know, if you're in another part of the state, you know, call us up, get in touch with you. We'll try to help you. We won't commit to funding necessarily, but we might, depending on what the circumstances are. We'd certainly like to talk to you, but we'll certainly help with consulting and try to get it done from the experience that we've had. And we have some people. I'm not the microforest expert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of the organizer of the group. But we have some people that are really very so you might say scientifically tuned in to the microforest project, and we can help. So if people are interested in that, just give us a call. They could call me even at 941-400-4156, and we can chat.
Okay, and just to be clear, Gene's not asking people to donate. He's just explaining to people how their program
exactly
works. Yeah.
So earlier in the interview, you mentioned two projects that you were proud of starting, and one of them was eco gardening or something like that?
Yes,
Green
Path Veterans Farms, and it's been transitioned to Operation Eco Vets.
Okay.
And they're working, the last communication I had with that, they're working with Selby Gardens, and they have a little garden there, and they provide greens for the restaurant.
That's great.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And there was another initiative that you said you were proud of.
Well, one thing that we do, which we don't really advertise very much, but we also help veterans directly if they're in particular need. And sometimes some of the vets and their families fall through the cracks. For one reason or another, they may not qualify for VA benefits, or we work a lot with Jewish Family and Community Services and Goodwill. And if for some reason those agencies are not able to help a vet, we may be able to. And we do that more or less on a routine basis. It's kind of a ongoing thing to help those veterans. And I'm proud to say we've kept several veterans off the street, which is very important.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So how many members do you have, and how many of those do you consider active, by which I mean participating either in meetings or initiatives that you have?
I would say participating, we have probably 50 people, something like that.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah, people they do a lot of different things. And, you know, to tell you the truth, it's hard for me to keep up with it. Which is good. That's a nice problem to have.
So I attended a meeting for Florida Veterans Common Sense at some church.
Yes, Unity Church.
Unity Church, and on just north of Proctor Road. Is that
yes,
right?
Correct.
And it was a talk by Dave Tomasco.
Yes.
And he was talking about why Sarasota Bay is improving and not improving. And so do you have organized meetings that you advertise that people can attend?
We have a meeting once a month, which is the second Tuesday of every month.
Mm-hmm.
And visitors are certainly welcome, and we encourage visitors to come. We have a lot of different programs and various subjects. I mean, Tomasco was a good example, because a lot of people want to know what's going on with our bay and how climate change is affecting our bay. I mean, and those that was one of the really a very interesting talk that Dave was able to give us. So we have really good programs. And so they're the second Monday of every month at 7 o'clock at the Unity Church on Proctor Road, and I don't remember the address, but it's you could also do it online, and we usually have as many people or more watching online as participating in live.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Or live.
Or live, yes.
Well, now I'm curious. In addition, you apparently wrote a book, a historical novel about Florida and the Civil War. Is that still in print?
That's still, you can get that on Amazon.
Okay,
yes.
And tell us about that book.
And that's a historical fiction, which I, you know, goes through some of the things that we talked about earlier about some of the battles in Florida and how bad it was in Florida and how it developed in Florida, and you know, really talking about the slavery issue. You know, it might even be considered a little bit woke because it really sets out, you know, what it may have been like for slaves at the time. In the book, the reason I wrote it was because I knew if I wrote something nonfiction, nobody would read it for sure. but as a fiction book, people have really liked it. It's really been popular. And so it's the name of it, Suwanee Divide. So if anybody's interested in the Civil War in Florida, you can get that book on Amazon.
And what does the divide refer to?
At the Suwanee River.
Yeah.
And the reason the Suwanee River was the divide, that started back with Andrew Jackson. Because when he invaded Florida, contrary to what Congress had told him, by the way, he only went as far as the Suwanee River. And the reason he invaded Florida was because the Seminole tribes were taking in a lot of escaped slaves. And they wanted to stop that trade because, of course, slaves were one of the most valuable assets that the plantation owners had.
Interesting.
And so they didn't want to lose their slaves, so Andrew Jackson tried to solve that problem.
It's really hard to imagine Florida before the proliferation of bridges. I mean, when you think about the Myakka River, trying to get from Sarasota to Arcadia, there was Rocky Ford, but you had to take your horse or cart, you know, across the limestone bottom of the river. Other than that, it was a ferry. You either needed a ferry or a boat. And so the rivers were real divides and really slowed down the movement of people and resources.
Well, that's one of the reasons that most of the development was along the coast, because they had those Gulf Coastal schooners,
right?
And they could run up and down and run it, and they had low, shallow draft, and they could run into the bays.
Yeah,
and that was the trading in Florida. It was definitely difficult to go inland.
Yeah, I think there was another ford. I've seen old maps that suggest roughly in the vicinity of where the whatever we call it, Myakka Road. Like when you're heading to the when you head across the bridge at the Myakka and Triangle Ranch is to the north and Myakka Park is more or less to the south. I've seen indications that there may have been a ford there as well, but rivers were a real impediment to movement.
And what's amazing with those Gulf Coastal schooners, they could take those a long way up the creeks and rivers.
Right.
So that was the way to transport goods and to communicate. That was the best. And that's another part about the Civil War, which is very interesting, because the North was very successful in blockading Florida. I mean, the blockade along the whole coast, and the center for that blockade was Key West.
Yeah.
So if Key West had not stayed in northern hands, it could have made a difference in the outcome of the war.
So we're familiar with John Muir's walk from Indiana to
Cedar Key. Well,
it's called the Thousand Mile Walk
to the Gulf.
To the Gulf,
right?
And he started in Indiana after he had an industrial accident that made him temporarily blind, and then when he got to Jacksonville,
Fernandina, I believe.
Fernandina.
Yeah.
He walked on a new railroad track that had connected Fernandina to Cedar Key, and this was after the Civil War. And along the way, he caught malaria, and he had planned a trip to the tropics. And then once he recovered from malaria, he decided he would go to California instead.
He did get to Cuba, but he didn't get to do the South American trip he dreamed of.
Right.
So the Sierra Club may owe its existence to malaria in Florida, because had he gone to South America, he could have died or been inspired. He, you know, at the time, before he got out west and saw the sequoias or whatever, he said the cabbage palm was the most impressive tree he'd ever seen. So so that was a big setback for the cabbage palm that he went west. But anyway.
Well, I haven't read that book in years, but I recall some of the descriptions of the Ocklawaha River.
Yeah.
And, you know, we almost can't imagine how wild it must have been. Yeah. I mean,
well, and I've just been writing in the last day or so. We had so many wild, incredible rivers in Florida that were unlike anything else in the country. And through subtraction, you know, we've dammed a bunch of them for water supply. We've channelized a bunch of them. We've phosphate mined a bunch of them. And so a river like the Myakka, which maybe 150 years ago, you know, it was special. It had its lakes and it had this warm mineral springs, but it was probably comparable to a number of rivers in Florida. Now it really stands out because it has not been dammed and water withdrawn and phosphated and channelized and otherwise impacted the way. Look at the what we did with the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee. Yeah, we've been lucky.
And the Kissimmee River, we turned into a ditch.
Yeah.
And so Florida's seen dramatic changes. There's no question about it.
There were, by different counts, about 50 rivers in Florida, and the Myakka accounts for only 1% of the river miles in the state of Florida.
Oh, that's kind of incredible.
Yeah.
Well, the other river system, which is really we're fortunate to have in Florida, well, there's two of them that are really special, of course, the St. John's and the Suwannee.
Right.
I mean, the Suwannee is still, surprisingly, most of its route is not developed in Florida.
Yeah. I'd love to canoe it, but I keep imagining getting hit in the head with a sturgeon.
Yeah. That could be possible. Yeah. That's happened.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online. And we are so grateful to our on-air supporters for contributing to the fund drive, and over last week, and we made our goals, and we have gained the $10,000 grant to upgrade the Joe Jacko studio, which we're broadcasting from.
Today's show, number 60, featured Gene Jones talking about climate change, microforests, a little bit about renewable energy, not much, and national security challenges.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.slr.org.
WSLR.
Oh, yeah, that would be good. WSLR.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment. This is a great place to look back at the topics of recent shows.
Tune in next week on April 22nd at 9 a.m. for the Healthy Living Hour with Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on April 28th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment, featuring a location interview in Venice.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.
And Gene, once again, thanks for coming in and telling us about Florida Veterans for Common Sense.
Well, thank you so much for having me.